Welcome to the Bill Barnwell Show. I'm Bill Barnwell, ESPN. We're here on Wednesday, June 27th, 2018. Joining me a little later is going to be new guest Matthew Doyle of MLS to talk about the World Cup and Germany's stunning departure. But first, we're going to talk about the NFL Hall of Fame. And we're going to talk to someone who has put in the research, who is significantly more qualified to talk about these about models when it comes to projecting Hall of Famers than me. So I'm going to defer to him, Brian Burke of ESPN. Mr. Burke, how are you?
I am well. Thanks for having me on, Bill.
Always a pleasure. You're always someone I want to hear stuff from because you always have a unique insight. You always have a studied, recent approach to things that other people do not take studied, recent approaches to. And that includes the Hall of Fame, which is a little less so in football than baseball, a point of contention. But something really interesting, you built a model last year to project players' chances of entering the Hall of Fame based on previous players. So if people didn't read that column last year, can you explain how it works?
Yeah, sure. Appreciate the kind words. I'll say that the model is smarter than I am. I am not a football historian by any means. Mm-hmm. I did grow up in the stands of Memorial Stadium as a Colts fan as a kid. So that's where my football knowledge begins. But thankfully, the computer here can be smarter than all of us put together. So the way this works, really what I wanted to do is teach myself something called neural networks, which I knew we were going to have to use with the player tracking data coming online. Mm-hmm. And so I thought this would be a fun project. I tried to mimic a Hall of Fame voter. Mm-hmm. And so I took all the, started with quarterbacks, and also did running backs, but I used the quarterbacks first. And I said, okay, let's look at their lifetime statistics, their attributes, postseason success criteria, and let this neural network create this artificial Hall of Fame voter and try to just kind of download his brain and see of the other guy, the candidates coming up, what their chances would be of being inducted.
Mm-hmm. So let's run through the quarterbacks here. We'll get to the running backs later, but let's run through the quarterbacks in a second. But first, just want to talk about a sponsor today. And you know what the sponsor is. You know they're always here. They always do wonderful work with us. It's SeatGeek. Very happy to work with them because SeatGeek is something I use on a weekly, monthly basis. And whenever I want to buy tickets to something where I don't have tickets previously, I go to SeatGeek and I get a reliable set of tickets and I get into the game that I want to go see, whether it's baseball, basketball, football, hockey. We're going to be talking about soccer later on with Matthew Doyle, who works for MLS. If you want to go to an MLS game, you might tickets for that on SeatGeek, MMA, boxing, golf, college basketball, college football, auto racing, soccer and tennis, concerts, and anything really you want to get tickets to that you can buy tickets for, SeatGeek will have them and get them to you. They'll get them to you reliably. You will get tickets that are not fake. You will get tickets that are a good deal because they're going to use their deal score technology. And you're going to get the widest variety of tickets because SeatGeek goes all around the web on a big old search for tickets and then uses their deal score technology to rate them. So you're getting the widest variety of tickets and you're getting the best deal on those tickets. And if that's not enough, whether you want to go see the MLB All-Star Game, whether you want to see this Taylor Swift tour, whether you want to see Jay-Z and Beyonce, whether you want to see MLS, you can get $20 off your first SeatGeek purchase by using my promo code, which is Barnwell, BARNWELL, my last name, Barnwell. Use that promo code in the SeatGeek app when you're purchasing tickets. You will get $20 back on your SeatGeek purchase. Can't beat that. Check out SeatGeek. Go to the app. Go to SeatGeek.com. Use my promo code Barnwell today. Let's talk about these quarterbacks. Now, granted, I mean, there are some pretty obvious ones, and you mentioned this last year. I would assume that nothing has changed, that Peyton Manning, Tom Brady, Drew Brees, Ben Roethlisberger, and Aaron Rodgers are all still 100% to make the Hall of Fame.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's a glut. I mean, it's insane. Yeah. So, in fact, I mean, Peyton Manning, Tom Brady, I'd use them I just assumed that they will make the Hall of Fame. Mm-hmm. And use them as the training set. So use them as, there are only 20 or so quarterbacks in the Hall of Fame as it is. So when you need a lot of data for this stuff, so I just assume they're already in, and that would help kind of teach the rest of the model, say, hey, this is the standard. This is the Hall of Fame bar kind of thing. So yeah, we have a glut. So Aaron Rodgers, Ben Roethlisberger, total shoe-ins, Drew Brees, you know, near 100%, all those guys. Eli Manning is probably the one kind of current player that people might have problems with. Mm-hmm. But if you, I think if you step back and look at his career production, adjusted for era, he's gonna come out very highly in the rankings.
Well, yeah, let's talk about Eli. I think he's someone who, when you talk about him and the Hall of Fame on the internet, it's funny because you have about 50% of people who seem to say that he's a lock of a Hall of Famer. He's won two Super Bowls. It would be crazy to keep him out. He is a generational player. And then you have the other 50% of people who seem to think, well, of course he can't go to the Hall of Fame. He's never been a standout quarterback. He has never been an all-pro. He is a guy who, at his worst, looks almost comically bad. I mean, yeah, I'm saying that as someone who grew up as a Giants fan. And I find myself between those two camps. So what does the model say in terms of Eli's Hall of Fame chances and sort of, like, you said about, you quoted about the stats adjusting for error. Is there something about Eli that really stands out as, like, the primary plank in his Hall of Fame candidacy?
Yeah, I mean, one thing we can do when you build models like this, you can play around with it. You can say, what if he wasn't, let's say he didn't win those Super Bowls.
Right.
You know, he lost both of them, or only won one, or wasn't MVP. And so the Super Bowl MVP really matters. One thing I would that I learned helps me deal with all this is it's the Hall of Fame. It's not necessarily the Hall of Stats or the Hall of Yards per Attempt or anything like that. It's a Hall of Fame. So if you might be, you know, let's just say Joe Flacco wins another Super Bowl MVP. I mean, nobody, if you look at his stats and his production and, you know, he's been carried a long way by his defense. He did have one great postseason, but if he did, he would come up. It would be really hard to argue to keep him out of the Hall of Fame. And Eli Manning is a better quarterback. He's got better production. He's got two rings, two MVPs. He's got the Pro Bowls to go with it. So it's very difficult to argue to keep him out. The only thing that I think will keep him out is this current glut. So he's at the bottom of this, easily at the bottom of this glut of quarterbacks who are all going to go in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. It seems like he's, you know, not maybe on the level of a Ben Roethlisberger or an Aaron Rodgers, but last year you listed a 72% chance of Eli Manning making the Hall of Fame. Is he still in that same sort of neighborhood for you?
I've rerun it, and it's up. It's higher. It's more like 90% for him.
Wow. Interesting.
Yeah, and it's just another year, another bunch of yards. Right. You know, so one of the things I learned is that, you know, you and I, we were trying to grade, like, how good a quarterback is. We're trying to predict how well he'll do in a season. Mm-hmm. When Hall of Fame voter looks, they're looking at kind of career totals.
Right.
They're looking at longevity, total yards, total QB wins, things like that. Probably stats we would reject as analysts, modern day analysts. But the Hall of Fame voters are kind of looking at career totals, total body of work type of thing.
Yeah, and this is a guy who, you know, for better or worse, he plays. He doesn't miss time. He's missed one game in the last 13 years, and it's because the Giants benched him. So, I mean, he's, you know, he might be the classic compiler. But you had a compiler who has two Super Bowl MVPs. It seems like that's enough to kind of push him over the line.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's you look at the narrative that it's, that the total picture builds, and he'll be in. Especially, I think he'll have to wait a long time. You know, his brother will be first ballot, of course, and sure. But he's the kind of guy who might have to wait, you know, 20 more years, 30 years. He might be an old man when he gets in, and that kind of that window of time kind of erases a lot of the you know, the people won't remember the bad Eli. They'll only remember the rings.
And that seems like it's a pretty common thing. You know, other guys in that tier perhaps don't have the Super Bowl MVPs, I'm assuming, are out. You mentioned Philip Rivers in the past, Carson Palmer, Tony Romo, Joe Flacco. I mean, Joe Flacco has the MVP, but it seems like those guys generally are probably looking in.
I would say right now, the last time I ran this, Philip Rivers and Matt Ryan are kind of marginal candidates. Mm-hmm. So either one of them, I think, makes a Super Bowl. I would say Philip Rivers makes a Super Bowl appearance. Matt Ryan wins it. Mm-hmm. If they had held on a couple of years ago, we'd be talking about Matt Ryan as a pretty strong candidate, especially if his, you know, he's only maybe what, three quarters at most through his career.
Right.
And he's still pretty much peaking. He's got a pretty strong offense around him. So we would, you know, we would think of Matt Ryan in very different terms. You know, had just a couple of plays gone the other way a couple of years ago.
What was his QBR in that game? The one where they, you know, they scored 29 points and lost. I mean, it was pretty good. I remember exactly. I think it was in the 80s, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, no. Yeah, he played as well as he could. Yeah, definitely.
It wasn't his fault. I don't know. 81.0 right. I mean, in that game, Matt Ryan.
But, right, but that's, you know, you and I will argue, well, he played well, he's a good quarterback,
right?
You know, it's not his fault. But in the annals of history, that doesn't quite matter. What matters is, you know, who's hoisting the trophy. So this is kind of a really different perspective from, you know, the kind of analytics and analysis that you and I might try to do.
Yeah, it's really interesting because, like you said, with Eli, as time fades, you're going to forget about the bad Eli. With Matt Ryan, it might be the same thing where you're going to forget about the fact that he was so good during the 2016 season and really great during the playoffs and was really good in that game against the Patriots. You're going to remember that they blew it, that they were in range to win the game and didn't blow it. And even if it wasn't Matt Ryan's fault, well, doesn't have that on his resume. Actually, let me ask you about that. Now that you mentioned that, in terms of the Eagle situation, where you had Carson Wentz in his second season, played an MVP level but get injured, did not win MVP, did not win the Super Bowl, obviously. He won a Super Bowl, but he was not the quarterback. Nick Foles was. How does that impact his sort of, obviously really early on, but his Hall of Fame candidacy after two seasons?
It depends on how you think about it. And that's hard. There's some, you know, I would say the closest comp would be Phil Simms right now, who the second Super Bowl was not his, but he was a quarterback for good part of that season. You know, he was still on the team. So most people would say, no, you don't credit Simms with that Super Bowl victory. I would guess that Wentz, would be thought of as the same way. So, you know, it's still early. I saw NFL.com ranked him somewhere in the second best player, third best player in the league. That's a bit of a stretch, I think, based on the sample size we've seen and the team around him, obviously. But yeah, I mean, he's one to watch. I would say of the really young the really young quarterbacks, the guys with the best chance, Russell Wilson would stand out. You know, he's got the Super Bowl already.
Yeah, and I mean, he certainly is still playing at a high level and still has plenty of years to go. I wonder what, and obviously you don't know this, you might have to guess, but what do you think the system would spit out for Wentz's chances had he stayed healthy and won MVP? Like, basically, he has the combined Carson Wentz Nick Foles season where he wins MVP and then wins the Super Bowl and wins Super Bowl MVP as well.
Yeah, no, all he would have to do at that point is stay in the league for a while. And, you know, probably 12-year career minimum, and that would be enough to put him in.
How do you think the Hall of Fame will end up handling guys like Matthew Stafford, where if we're in an era now where passing is up more than ever before, and if Matthew Stafford stays healthy and has good receivers and plays into his late 30s, which is not out of the question, this is a guy who can end up, if he doesn't win a Super Bowl, you know, could end up having the passing title, at least for a short period of time. Do you think the Hall of Fame voter is likely to continue on this sort of path where they're not really as concerned about stats, or will the stats get so sort of, you know, overwhelming that guys who aren't necessarily great quarterbacks, who are just pretty good quarterbacks to stick around for a long time, might have a better chance of getting in than they did, you know, 20 or 30 years ago?
Yeah. All the stats I've been using in these models are adjusted for era. And Stafford doesn't really come up as a candidate yet. He doesn't have the postseason. I mean, he's got I think 3 postseason appearances, and that's it. So he's got to make a run at least at some point. And in terms of just total kind of wins, and he's got the total yards, but I think his team needs to accomplish more around him before people think of him as a real candidate.
So in terms of running backs, you also have done research in that space as well. You mentioned last year that Terrell Davis sort of marked a change for running backs as he got in on a relatively short career. Do you think that's a sign that the Hall of Fame might be changing for running backs? And given that Hall of running backs do seem to have shorter careers now, that they are going to start rewarding guys who have, you know, you don't have to be a Jerome Bettis, that you can maybe have a 6 or 7 year career and still be a viable Hall of Fame candidate?
It might be changing. He is quite an outlier in terms of he kind of carried his team, a kind of postseason performance. It's still in people's minds. He's a super likable guy. I think that goes into it. I think, you know, the kind of the tragic nature of, you know, what could have been kind of career kind of goes in his favor. Yeah. So the only comp to him, was Gale Sayers, and Gale Sayers even had one more year as a starting running back than Dave. I mean, Davis realistically only had 4 years as a starter. Mm-hmm. I mean, he kind of hung on there at the end, but his injury really didn't let him perform. But he stands out in terms of like efficiency. So I think maybe voters might be looking at efficiency now the way they never would before, and you know it. I wouldn't be shocked if you know podcasts like this were kind of part of that kind of generational change. But yeah, he really does. He is an outlier. It's not for me to say he should be in or shouldn't be in, but yeah, it's inconsistent with what other previous kind of Hall of Fame voting classes would have done.
Mm-hmm. So currently, right now, you're looking at the veterans who are retired who are not in. You're looking at players like Edgerrin James, Priest Holmes, Sean Alexander, Eddie George. Do you think any of those running backs are likely to get in?
I think so. They'd have to wait. There's only one current running back, and that's Adrian Peterson, who's kind of in, right? So there's not going to be a huge backlog of running backs. But none of those folks, you know, Priest Holmes, the 2000 Super Bowl, not really his, but he does have a ring. So depending on how you think about that, he was a starter for most of the year, though. There are other guys, too, older guys, O.J. Anderson and Roger Craig right now. So my most recent version of this model really likes those guys. And if you dig deep into, you know, you go read about those guys, there's definitely a case to be made.
Yeah, Roger Craig, part of those great 49ers offenses, and you know, maybe overshadowed a bit by Jerry Rice and Joe Montana, but still a really good player.
Oh, gosh. And, longevity, he's got a lot going for him. He's got the championships, the postseasons. O.J. Anderson was the workhorse for the Giants in the 80s, 2 rings. So I think that, you know, the voters might take a look at somebody like that before any of the, you know, Frank Gore type players who don't have the championships, have the longevity. Mm-hmm. So I would put my chips on O.J. Anderson or Roger Craig before them.
Mm-hmm. So what about that? This sort of group of modern players who are currently in the league? It seems like you mentioned Shady McCoy and Frank Gore in your piece last year. It seems like Le'Veon Bell, Marshawn Lynch could be guys who are also in the discussion. Do any of them, you think, have currently a reasonably good chance of making the Hall of Fame?
I think Bell needs a championship. Mm-hmm. But definitely. So any of the people who are still, you know, playing can, you know, with a ring or run deep into the postseason, that really matters. Number of all pros seems to really matter for running backs too. LeSean McCoy has 2. Frank Gore doesn't have any. But when you look at the guys who are in, their number of all pros and Pro Bowl numbers are really, really big. And so, whereas for quarterbacks, voters kind of tend to attribute the team performance to the quarterback, running backs less so. So you can, but in that case, they're going to rely on the all pros and the Pro Bowls. And you can imagine the kind of, you know, the inside the voting room, you know, there's somebody assigned to make the case for a certain player who's a candidate. And when you make that case, what are you going to rely on? you're gonna list the, you know, tick those kind of attributes off: number of all pros, number of Pro Bowls, you know, postseason appearances, total yard. That's what you're gonna make your case on. It's easy to kind of imagine that. And you know, all pros, things like that. I know we can discount Pro Bowls. Those are, you know, sometimes popularity contests, especially in modern days. But all pros aren't. So if you're a running back who's racking up multiple all pros, that definitely says, hey, you are, you know, compared to your cohort in your era, you're the best. And so I think the all pro really makes a difference. And that's where, like, guys like O.J. Anderson and Roger Craig are kind of lacking. They've only got one each.
Right. Yeah. Le'Veon Bell, of course, now two really healthy seasons for him as a starter during his 5-year career when he's been a first team all pro both times. So seems like he is, you know, still a lot to go, but on a relatively positive track. So, I mean, if you
there's
were
nobody
to, you
with were, three, there's well, no running back ever. With three all pros is not in. So, really? You know, you get three. That's hard to keep you out.
Yeah. So, I mean, if you were, maybe this is a little too difficult, but let's finish up with this. If you were just projecting a running back to make the Hall of Fame, what's sort of the baseline? Would it be win a championship and have three all pro seasons? Is it that simple? Is it to, you know, run for a certain amount of yards? Is there a baseline number you can think of? Or
no, I don't think you don't have to. The postseason and the Super Bowl doesn't matter quite as much for running backs as it would for quarterbacks. Definitely, yeah, rack up the all pros and the Pro Bowls. That's what's going to really, really help you. So there's, you know, Eric Dickerson never even appeared in a Super Bowl. LaDainian Tomlinson never appeared. O.J. Simpson, Gale Sayers. I'm looking down my list right now. Gifford. I would say Gifford. Yeah, he was in a championship. Right. Curtis Martin made a Super Bowl. Earl Campbell never made one. So there's, I think individual performance, individual accomplishment is what the running back voters look at.
Yeah, makes sense. Well, Brian, always a pleasure to have you on. Where can people check out more of what you do for ESPN?
ESPN.com. I show up on there, but lately I'm not publishing much. We've got some really, really cool top secret stuff in the pipeline, and hopefully we're going to be able to showcase that this season. Very cool stuff.
See,
coming your way.
The problem is it's top secret to me too, and I want to know what it is, so I'm going to try and get it out of you when we get offline.
We heard you're coming to Bristol soon. We're going to give you show and tell.
Yeah, I'm excited. I'm on my way. All right, Mr. Burke, thank you so much. We're going to come back with more Bill Barnwell Show here in a moment. All right, back here on the Bill Barnwell Show, I'm joined now by a new guest, someone who has not appeared on the show before, to talk about the World Cup. And we're going to record this in between the morning set of games here on Wednesday and the afternoon set, I guess, on U.S. time. But joining me to discuss the stunning departure of Germany from the World Cup is MLS's Matthew Doyle. Matthew, how are you?
Unprecedented departure, Bill.
That's
unprecedented.
True.
It's amazing. They've literally never gone out in the group stage before. So I'm doing well. I like chaos, and that's what we got today.
Certainly, it felt like chaos. It is fair to say, though, that the Germany's history of never going out in the group stage of a World Cup came up against the vaunted and apparently real, I don't know if it's true, World Cup winner's curse. Do you believe that's an actual thing?
I mean, four of the last five have gone out in the group stage. I think the only one to get out was Brazil in 2006, and they had kind of a down World Cup that year anyway and lost in the quarterfinals. Mm-hmm. It's hard to keep that hunger. I know there's more turnover. I mean, obviously, there's more turnover in 4 years in this game than you see in, you know, year after year with a team like the Patriots, or, you know, all the way back to the disease of Moore that Pat mm-hmm. Riley wrote about 35, 40 years ago with the Lakers. There seems to be something to it. There seems to be something to it. And if you're, you know, a head of a federation, you have to think a little bit about, you know, making sure and holding the coach accountable in terms of changing over players and making sure that a new hungry generation gets in there and doesn't fall on their faces like the Germans did this past week.
Yeah, I was just going to ask you about that with Jogi Löw. I mean, it seemed like even throughout this group stage, they never really seemed to have an answer for their problems in midfield. They cycled through Sammy Kadira, Sebastian Rudy, Leon Goretzka was in today. They dropped Mesut Ozil. They then dropped Thomas Müller for the match today. I mean, it seemed like there was never a coherent plan as much as just trying different players and hoping that they seemed to fix whatever was flawed with this German team.
Yeah, I think that's it. And it's weird because this German team has been so good over the past 3.5 years. Mm-hmm. You know, we saw them, they weren't great in the Euros, but they were good. And then they were great last summer. And they were great in qualifying. They kept checking the boxes. So there was no sense that things were amiss heading into this tournament, but I guess I just got complacent. And I do think that the Sebastian Rudy injury, you know, that caused them some problems because I thought the best half hour they played, you know, was the half hour he was on the field. And without him, they didn't really have that ball winner because Kadir is not the guy he was 3 years ago. And I think it ended up asking Cruz to, I don't know if it asked him to do too much, but it made him uncomfortable. And it's just one of those butterfly effect things. If you're not quite as solid there as you need to be, then everybody plays 5-10% worse. And even if you're as talented as Germany, that leaves a door open.
So, I mean, at this point with Germany, do you think this is time for wholesale change? Do you see, you know, 4 or 5 players maybe retiring from international football? Do you see a possible coaching change there? Or do you think maybe you just sort of retool and try to come back in the European Championship cycle with a lot of the same players?
I don't think there's any question that they have the talent to come back in 2 years and you know, be absolutely one of the favorites in the Euros. Whether Yogi Löw is the coach or not, I feel like it should be an open question. But the German Federation, they're not an overreacting type of bunch, and they've already extended him through the next World Cup. So I think I would be a little bit surprised if we've seen the end of him. I would not be surprised if we've seen the end of the Kadira, Ozil, maybe even Thomas Müller, certainly Mario Gomez, maybe Boateng and Hummels. I would not be surprised if we have seen the end of that generation and they really do clear it out and bring in the kids starting really in this first camp that they'll have 2 months from now in August. Because, I mean, we've seen it happen in every sport. And like you said, we've seen it happen repeatedly with you know, defending World Cup champs. Things go stale. And sometimes it's worth sacrificing the 5% of talent for the 15% of youth and sort of naive will to get out there and make your own mark. And I would guess that's what's going to happen for Germany.
The sad thing is you can have things get stale and struggle unexpectedly without winning a World Cup, as we discovered domestically during this World Cup cycle. On the flip side, in terms of the Mexico-Sweden match, you actually brought up a really good comparison, I felt like, on Twitter, which was that it felt like it was very similar to 2002, where you had the U.S. getting blown out by Poland in a very uncompetitive game, and Mexico was forced to rely on Korea to hold out against a big European power, which they did in 2002. And they did, of course, this afternoon by beating Germany. So Mexico lost. It was an unimpressive performance, and it was a match where Juan Carlos Osorio, of course, the MLS-educated manager coaching the Mexican national team, now stuck with the same formation unexpectedly 2 games in a row. Was this a formation issue for you, or was it just a game where so many things went wrong that you almost wouldn't fault Osorio for the team he put out there?
I don't really fault Osorio for this one, and it wasn't just the same formation. It was the same 11. It was the same players that he had used in the previous game. It was the first time in 51 games as manager of Mexico that he had done that, and it goes completely against everything that we know of Juan Carlos Osorio in his career. He's notorious for rotating players, changing formation, lineup, changing, you know, where on the field players play, changing the line of confrontation, everything. And the fact that he stuck with it and gave the guys who had played, I think, really well in the first 2 games a chance to go out there and finish the job off, I'm not inclined to blame him at all for this. I think this was a case of the players coming out there and thinking, like, just feeling like the job was done and being flat. And it's very similar to, like you said, it's very similar to what happened with the U.S. 16 years ago. And, I mean, it's eerie the way Korea, like, Korea had nothing to play for. They weren't going to go through. They could have laid down and died, and we've seen teams all over the world do that, in not just the World Cup, but in regional tournaments as well. But they went out there and they played their hearts out, and they got a last-second win. It is bizarre. It is bizarre to see this happen again, and I have a lot of Mexican American friends who are over the moon, ecstatic right now, and I think we're all going to Koreatown tonight for dinner and and some soju.
Yeah, I can't blame you there. I mean, it's fascinating for Mexico because, of course, they look so good during the first two matches. To see them really drop off here in the third match of the group stage, and the hidden factor here, not hidden factor is the wrong word, and we're recording this in advance of the Group E final matches, but right now it's certainly likeliest. The most likely scenario is that Brazil will win the group, which would mean that Mexico, having finished second in Group F, will end up playing Brazil. Is that a... It seems like that's a much worse matchup for Mexico than Switzerland would have been had they won the group and Switzerland finished second as expected.
Yeah, I mean, Mexico always play well against Brazil. It's one of the things that U.S. national team fans rightly envy Mexico for, but there's no question. Brazil are just a better, more talented team than Switzerland. They're arguably the favorites in this tournament now that Germany are out. If you're a Mexican fan or one of those players or the coach, you have to be a little bit disappointed at that because they could have given themselves an easier path. But at the same time, you know, they've already beaten Germany in this tournament, and like I said, they have a great record over the years against Brazil. They should go in there with the idea that they can at the very least compete. Hold on to the ball a little bit, and Brazil will come up. You know, they'll bring that back line up the field, and they'll give guys like Vela and Chicharito space to run into. So it's not a foregone conclusion, though Brazil will be heavy favorites.
Yeah, you would figure. So let's run through the groups that are currently completed as we record this on Wednesday. We'll start in Group A, naturally, with Uruguay and Russia going through. And I have to admit, I'm still a little skeptical of Uruguay. I mean, that defense obviously is quite impressive. They didn't allow any goals in the group stage. Rare occasion of that happening, although it happened to them, I think, a decade ago or so. So Uruguay defense is obviously very, very sound. The attack, I mean, they did score three goals against Russia, but it's for the talent that's there, for the names that are there at the top of that attack, it hasn't necessarily lived up to at least what my expectations were heading into the tournament. So do you think that Uruguay have impressed in the group stage? And do you think that they have enough to sort of make a deep run into this tournament?
I don't expect them to go particularly far, though. They are playing a Portugal team that haven't really impressed me either. So they could make it back to the quarterfinals. And, you know, like you said, they have a talented attack. The problem is it's an imbalanced attack, right? Their talent is all in Luis Suarez and Edinson Cavani. And both those guys are still great, but they're not as great as they were 4 years ago.
Sure.
So a lot of what they do is they stay compact and they scrap and they rely a little bit on, you know, the brilliance of those two guys, but a lot on opportunism, and they don't make mistakes. This is a team that they just never give away cheap goals. And if you do that, you give yourself a shot, and it's never worked to the extent where you could actually just, that's your whole game plan and go all the way and win a World Cup. But every tournament, there's at least one or two teams that make it all the way to the quarterfinals just by being damn hard to play against. And Uruguay's made a living off of that over the years. And it wouldn't shock me if they upset everybody and beat Portugal. I think people around the world, neutrals anyway, probably want to see both Portugal and Argentina advance, because that would give us Ronaldo versus Messi in the World Cup quarterfinals. And I mean, who could possibly say no to that?
finally we get an answer to the question of who was better, Ronaldo or Messi. Quite clearly, right. It'd just be a one-on-one battle. We'll get to Portugal in a second, but in terms of Russia, again, sort of a similar thing where it seems hard to really judge them given that the strength of competition during the first two matches was not especially impressive. And certainly they did rest some guys during the Uruguay match and didn't put out a full-strength first team. Are you hopeful of their chances against Spain, especially given that they are still playing at home?
No. I would be pretty surprised if Spain didn't pass through Russia like a warm knife through butter. I think they were pretty well exposed by Uruguay, and mm-hmm. Credit to them for what they did against Saudi Arabia and Egypt. But as you said, that's not the stiffest level of competition, and I think it was Nate Silver at 538. They ran the numbers, and Russia got literally the easiest group in modern World Cup history, mm-hmm. which is, of course, a big coincidence and everything. But they took advantage of it, and then once they played a pretty good team, they got just dragged. And so, if Spain do anything but win convincingly, I think that should be considered kind of shocking.
Well, I wanted to ask you about Spain too, and getting the Group B, because I mean, I have to admit, this isn't a tournament where we've had really many dominant teams, but I'm still pretty skeptical of Spain in this tournament where, of course, the names are there, the talent's there, but look at their tournament. I mean, they blew a lead against Portugal. They were arguably then outplayed by Iran and then really labored against Morocco. I mean, it wasn't like they were impressive in those final two games at all. So are you, when you say you're confident Spain will beat Russia, I mean, do you think this is a Spanish team that maybe has to make some changes? Versus the person that we saw in the group stage, we had Santiago Canizari suggest this week that they should consider dropping Andres Iniesta and David Silva, which is basically heretical.
Yeah, it's almost sacrilege, but I'm there with him. Mm. I think Iniesta, I love him, and I wish he was coming to MLS, but I think he's at the World Cup level. You can't ask him to play 80 minutes, 70 minutes, back to back to back over the course of 9 days, and he was mm-hmm. really laboring. And I think Silva's probably still a starter, but they need to be a little bit more adventuresome in maybe making some subs who can provide a little bit of directness out of that midfield, because they're still playing at times like it's tiki taka, and they don't have prime Iniesta, and they obviously they don't have Xavi anymore mm-hmm. either, and those guys were the system. So it's been a struggle, but at the same time, we're not really talking about it as a struggle if the real David De Gea shows mm-hmm. up.
Right,
he's like, to me, he's the single greatest shot stopper in the world. And, maybe the best pure shot stopper since Schmeichel, mm-hmm. And that guy has not been in the World Cup. David De Gea has been terrible this World Cup. So I think if he comes back, and I expect him to, and mm-hmm. plays like we know he can, and they make the necessary change in central midfield, I expect Spain to look like a contender, really.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's been no country for old men, really, in this tournament. Iniesta struggled. Rafa Marquez has been an absolute disaster, a sub for Mexico. Javier Mascherano has been troublesome for Argentina, certainly brave, but not necessarily playing very effectively. And yet, Cristiano Ronaldo seems to be just fine. Does seem interesting. So, I would say Portugal-Uruguay does not sound like a very fun match, but do you have a team you favor in that comparison?
Probably Portugal, because they have Ronaldo.
That's a good reason.
To me, it's a coin. Like you said, it's not going to be a fun match. Portugal crossed the ball a million times. They don't play through the midfield as they should. And we mm-hmm. saw they started out the first 10, 12 minutes against Iran. They were great because Carvalho was all over the ball and he was able to spread the field around. And then Iran just started man-marking him. Mm-hmm. And Portugal never figured it out. 75 minutes they played this game and never figured out that their number six was being man-marked, and they never made any adjustments. So they're not a particularly sophisticated team. Uruguay will take advantage of that to some degree, but they have Ronaldo. have Ronaldo. And I know Ronaldo for Portugal in the World Cup isn't the same Ronaldo for Real Madrid in the Champions League, but he's still freaking Ronaldo. And I am not going to be foolish enough to pick against him.
That's fair. And the other match on that side of the bracket, it's France-Argentina. Of course, Argentina did manage to advance to the next round of the World Cup. I think it's still fair to say there are major question marks about that team and changes that have not yet managed to stick to improve this Argentina team. It seems like France's pace is going to give Argentina quite a bit of trouble.
I think that's fair. I think, you know, you and me and your producer here would be faster than the Argentinian center backs, and they still have this weird Sampaoli induced desire to play, to bring that back line really far up and play that far on the front foot, and they can't do it. They can't do it, and you, especially against Mbappe and you know Dembele if he's in there, Lamar, like France will just shred that. And Deschamps is only too happy to sit deep and just release guys into space. So it'll be an interesting tactical battle in the sense that I don't think either manager has any idea what they're doing. And this is like, you know, the greatest player in the world, for my money, the greatest player the world has ever seen against, you know, arguably the most talented team in the world currently, and we have no idea how it's actually going to play out. So it's fun in a very root for chaos type of way.
That sounds exciting enough to me. Do you think Argentina makes more changes? Like, do you think Ever Banega keeps his place? Do you think they stick with Higuain over Aguero? Or do you think it's just, we were able to get through, let's just stick with that and hope it works out for us next time?
I mean, they got to keep Banega. I thought he was, you know, other than Messi, he was their best player yesterday. And I mean, I would pick Aguero over Higuain 100 times out of 100, but you know that there are long-term, long-time politics at play in that camp, and it's not clear whether Sampaoli is picking the squad or Mascherano and Messi are. So it's tough to say. It really is tough to predict, but if they go to that back three, I will be shocked. I do think that they will stay with the back four, and they will have, you know, try to make it a solid central midfield again, and give Messi that completely free role. Beyond that, it's tough to guess the personnel.
Yeah, and it's not clear whether Messi and Mascherano are better at picking the team than Sampaoli at this point. I'm not entirely sure that myself. So that'll be a fascinating match. And then on the flip side of the tournament, final match that we have currently set up is Denmark and Croatia. Of course, Croatia, very impressive, it looked like, in the group stage. Do you think Denmark has the midfield behind Eriksen, not really in a creative sense, but more in a defensive sense, to hold up against a really impressive Croatian midfield at this point?
That's the question, right? And because Modric has been arguably the best player in the tournament so far, and you know, Rakitic is up there as well, and those, you know, that front line that Croatia have, they're not the most talented individuals in the world, but they work together so well. And that has always troubled teams. Teams like that have always troubled Denmark, who have always been more about, you know, silky possession and keeping the ball and being a little bit elegant rather than being hard and maybe a little cynical through midfield. This team feels a little bit different. They really do. And we saw some of that against France. So I think they have a good shot, but Croatia are, to me, they're prohibitive favorites there.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like if you're going to pick an upset or a team that's not, you know, that was not favored in the tournament to go far, it seems like right now Croatia would be that team, no?
Yeah, it does. It definitely does. And I think that would, honestly, it's another one that would make a lot of neutrals happy, because this generation of Croatians, they've played such good soccer over the years, but they've never really put it together in a big tournament, be it the Euros or the World Cup. And if they make it happen here, and especially Modric is one of the great underappreciated soccer players of this generation, and, you know, since I've been watching the game 35 years ago, really, to see him have a tournament like this and keep it going, I think would make a lot of people very happy.
Yeah. Well, Matthew Doyle, thanks so much for coming on. Where can people check out more of what you do?
You can find me on Twitter at MattDoyle76. And everything I write, everything I podcast, all the videos I make are at MLSsoccer.com. And get yourself out to a game this summer, folks. Come support the beautiful game at home.
Yes, wonderful. Matt, thanks so much.
Thanks, Bill.
All right, thanks so much to my guests today, Brian Burke of ESPN and Matthew Doyle of MLS. No show next week. We're going to be off for the holiday. It's also my birthday. Happy birthday to me. Thank you for remembering it to myself. But we're going to do a show, I believe, the week after, probably some more World Cup stuff and some more NFL as we're getting almost ready to preview the 2018 season. More audio coming in a couple of weeks. Thanks for listening.